You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hello, everybody. Elliot Forrest here. Leonard Lopate is on vacation. We've long known that the Hopi people have no word for time and thought that Eskimos have an unusually large number of words for snow. But to what degree do these differences in language actually change the way we view the world? If the Hopis have no word for time, does that really mean they can't understand the ticking of a clock? But there are other more subtle ways that language affect our view of the world. Here today to tell us about the latest research in this field known as linguistic relativity is Guy Deutscher. Mr. Deutscher is an honorary research fellow at the School of Languages, Linguistics, and Cultures in the University of Manchester. His article, "Does Your Language Shape How You Think?" appeared in the August 29th issue of the New York Times Magazine. His latest book, "Through the Language Glass, Why the World Looks Different in Other Languages," is published this month by Metropolitan Books, and it's a pleasure to welcome Guy today. Hi there.
Hi, pleasure to be with you.
This idea that the language we speak to some extent determines our view of the world is not a new one. Some 70 years ago, a guy named Benjamin Lee Whorf had some writings. Tell us about him and what he wrote.
That's right. Well, it actually goes even further. But Whorf in 1940 made this idea very famous and very seductive. And he essentially said that the languages we speak completely determines our thoughts and what we are able to think. That, as you said just before, if a language doesn't have a word for a certain concept, then its speakers will not be able to understand this concept. Like if Hopi doesn't have a word for or future tense, then its speakers will not be able to understand the concept of the future and so on. These ideas became extremely popular in the 1940s and 50s and 60s.
By scientists, by linguistics, by the public? Everyone accepted them at the time?
Yes, by scientists, anthropologists, linguists, and the general public. A range of really quite incredible claims were made about alleged examples of how language limits our ability to understand or think in this way. People made all sorts of inferences from the claim that, for example, that the tense system or the lack of a tense system in ancient Hebrew determined the Israelites' conception of time, eternity, and God, and things like that. But after a while, it became apparent that actually there's never been any evidence to back up such claims, and no one has really proved or shown that the language that we speak limits our ability to think or to think logically or to understand certain concepts. So the whole idea that language is a sort of prison house that we can't think thoughts or understand distinctions of concepts that don't have words, that don't have sort of ready-made labels in our language, has been entirely discredited. And today, as I said in the Times article, just voicing this idea almost puts you on the sort of fringe of academic respectability. So
Whorf's hypothesis, when did it start to fall out of favor?
It essentially was the same with the what today is known as cognitive science and the Chomsky revolution, with the idea that much of structure of language is actually coded in the genes and therefore necessarily the same across the human race. According to this idea, since all languages deep down are really, then it wouldn't make sense that any particular language can influence its speakers in any fundamental way that differs from another language. And that idea rose to prominence from the 60s and 70s. Onwards.
And I guess it also, some of it kind of makes sense in a way, because one likes to think you come up with new ideas, that you actually learn something new, and you'd hate to think that that was limited by the language, by your language.
I mean, that's right. There are thousands of counterexamples to this view that the language, the concepts in your language limit what you're able to understand. And what you said is exactly right. It's just think about it this way: if it was right, then you would never be able to learn anything new. If the ready-made labels or concepts in your language were the absolute limit of what you'd able to understand, you'd be stuck with them for the rest of your life. And we know that's not the case.
You touched on this a little bit. Talk about the other theory, which is language is biologically determined. Expand on that a little bit.
This has been one of the most controversial questions or debates of the last few decades. And the theory that's certainly dominant today among linguists and cognitive scientists is the theory that was initially put forward by Noam Chomsky, that the structure of our language is predetermined, that it is coded in the DNA in some sense, and that children who learn their mother tongue don't actually have to learn its structure. The fundamental aspects of its structure. They merely use the building blocks that are provided by the genes.
I'm Elliot Forrest, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking to Guy Deutscher. You may have seen his recent article in the New York Times Magazine, Does Your Language Shape How You Think? His latest book is called Through the Language Glass, Why the World Looks Different in Other Languages. You quote a linguist in your book by the name of Jacobson, and here's the quote: languages differ essentially in what they must convey and not in what they may convey. Can you explain that?
Yes, that is a quote from the Russian linguist Roman Jakobson. He wasn't actually talking about the influence of language on thought, but I think that his very pithy maxim is the key to understanding the actual influence of our mother tongue on the way we think, because the point is not the different languages actively forbid you to think anything, because in theory every language can express anything. Even if it doesn't have a ready-made word for something, it can still express any thought with a few more words and some circumlocutions. But where languages really differ is in the types of information that each language forces us to specify when we describe events in the world. The example I use there, which was also a Jakobson's example to start with, is if I say in English that I spent yesterday evening with a neighbor, you may wonder whether my neighbor was male or female, but I have the right to tell you exactly that it's none of your business.
I have no idea if you're speaking English, but that's not the same with other languages.
Exactly. So if we're speaking Russian or German or French, I wouldn't have this privilege of equivocally, because the grammar of the language would oblige me to tell you whether, by the choice of words, whether it was a female or a male neighbor that I spent yesterday evening with. And so of course, this doesn't mean that English cannot express the difference. If an English speaker wants to, you can just say, I spent the last evening with a male neighbor or female one. But in English, you don't have to do it, whereas in some languages, you do.
So what does that say about the culture? Because not that I've done it, but yes, I could say that sentence and sort of deliberately hide the fact as to whether the gender of the person I was with was male or female, not that I've ever done it. But it sounds like the French have no choice. They always have to reveal the gender of the person they were with when they say that sentence.
That is right. And that means that the French or the speakers of any language which obliges you to do this have to pay attention to this element of, or this type of information, this type of, or this detail, whenever they speak about, you know, neighbors or friends or doctors or teachers or a host of other people, whereas speakers of English don't do this.
And, maybe that's why the French are just so French. Let me move on to, you spend a large portion of your book discussing when the words for certain colors started, that there was actually a time when language only expressed black and white. Is that true?
Yes, probably. Can I just, I'll just add one more sentence about the previous question.
Sure.
The real influence of language on thought, I think, is that exactly in the habits that each language imposes on us by forcing us to specify certain types of information. So when a language forces you to be attentive to certain types of details of the world from infancy, in order to be able to speak and to be able to understand what people around you are saying, then these habits of speech can create habits of mind more generally that go beyond language. And the essence of the influence of language is not what it limits us or what it prevents us from understanding, but in the habits that it creates by forcing us to do certain things. Now, the color that you mentioned is another example of this. It's true that the way that our language divides up the color spectrum, which to us seems entirely natural and elementary. So we think that green and blue are really just different colors, whereas light blue and dark blue are just really just shades of the same color. But it turns out that this is actually a cultural convention, and that languages vary quite radically in how they divide the spectrum. There are reports of languages that essentially only have two color terms that divide the whole spectrum into just dark and light, or black and white. This seems extremely rare, though, but what is much more common are languages that divide spectrum into three categories, and that invariably is red, black, and white. So in those languages, anything that has a tint of redness in it would be called red, whether it's brown or pink or orange, whereas any bright shade that doesn't have a tint of redness would be white, and any dark shade.
You have
dark.
A couple of pictures in your book that actually sort of hint that not only do different cultures and different languages have different words for different colors, but because of that, we may actually see differently, see color differently?
Yes, I think there's been quite a lot of research over the last few years that showed with really quite ingenious experiments that colors that, or the distinctions in color that our language forces us to make, seem to have an effect on the actual perception of color in reality. And what happens is that the our brain somehow learns to exaggerate the differences between shades that have different colors. So if your language makes a or if your language treats blue and green as separate colors, you are trained, or you're trained, to exaggerate the difference between shades that are near the border, sort of the turquoise shades, and makes, so we are sort of trained to see greenish blues as a bit more blue than they really are, and bluish greens as a bit more green, compared to speakers of languages which don't treat these as separate colors. So, as I say, in some sense, our appreciation of a Chagall painting depends on whether we have a word for blue in our language or not.
I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lope, talking to Guy Deutscher. You may have seen his recent article in the New York Times Magazine called Does Your Language Shape How You Think? And his latest book is called Through the Language Glass. We got a call, Mr. Deutscher, from a neurobiologist who mentioned that men and women have different circuits in the brain when it comes to language. Could this have something to do with how we perceive color as well?
That is quite possible. We're really just beginning to understand what is going on in the brain, and some of the experiments that have that were conducted in the last years seem to show that even the left, the two halves of the brain, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, actually react slightly differently to the perception of color, because the left hemisphere is the one where the most linguistic circuits are located. And so in the left hemisphere, there seems to be more influence coming from the language on the visual perception than from the in the right hemisphere. So I'm not aware of the men and women difference, but it's quite plausible that it's there. And the point is that these studies that look to us incredibly sophisticated and are really very ingenious. We are in a pioneering stage in all that concerns understanding how the brain circuits work. We really know very little. We have MRI scans that can tell us where particular activity takes place in the brain and when it does perform certain tasks. We are nowhere near being able to understand or listen in on what's actually being said, say, by the neurons, see how in detail how any color perception or any other sort of abstract concept is coded. There's an enormous amount that it's still to be learned, as the technology becomes more advanced, I'm sure there'll be a whole new world that will open up in understanding the precise nature of the influence of language on thought.
My guest is Guy Deutscher. Stay there. We're going to come back to you in just a moment. His latest book is called Through the Language Glass, Why the World Looks Different Through Other Languages. It's published by Metropolitan Books. We'll continue after this break. Stay with us. Leonard Lopate is on a well-deserved vacation. I'm Elliot Forrest. My guest is Guy Deutscher. His latest article in the New York Times Magazine was called Does Your Language Shape How You Think? And his latest book, Through the Language Glass, Why the World Looks Different in Other Languages. Mr. Deutscher, let's talk about the perception of space. I found this particularly interesting that certain cultures and certain languages would use left, right. Other cultures would use northeast, southwest to describe the simplest of things. That seemed awful confusing to me. Talk to me about that.
Yes, it's extremely counterintuitive. This is research that's been done mostly or been centered with a team in the Max Planck Institute in Nijmegen in the Netherlands. And it was inspired by an Australian Aboriginal language from northeast Queensland called Gugurimi here, which turns out not to use any expression for what can be called egocentric coordinates. So they don't use left or right, but not even things like in front of or behind. And instead, for any type of spatial description, they would use the cardinal directions north, west, south, or east. So they would say things like there's a crumb on your western cheek, or there's a giant ant just north of your foot, or I left something on the southern edge of the western table in the northern room in your house.
Is that intuitive for them, or do they always have compasses, or do they just always know where north is?
Well, the thing is that that's exactly the amazing thing. They seem to have an unfailing sense of orientation. They almost seem to have a sat-nav, a GPS system built into their brain, except that it's even more reliable than sat-nav because it works indoors and whatever the visibility conditions, even in caves, this ability isn't for them is entirely taken for granted. They when they tell you that the ant just north of your foot, they don't pause for a moment to look at the sun or the wind or whatever. They don't do any conscious computations. They just feel it in the same way we would feel where in front of you, in front of us or behind us is. So when they were asked, you know, how do you know? They just can't say it. Just like you won't be able to say how you know where in front of you is.
You give a great example in your article. It's as if a dance instructor would say to us, now raise your north hand and move your south leg eastward.
Exactly. Well, that sounds to us the height of absurdity. It sounds completely counterintuitive, almost mad. But it turns out that there are other languages around the world. It's not just this freak phenomena in northern Australia. The example is actually inspired by something from Bali in Indonesia, where it seems that dancing instructions are given in exactly this way.
That would be so hard.
Well, to us it would be, but if that's what you grew up with, then it seems entirely natural to you.
Well, I guess that is the point, the way the language is affecting the brain. Let me just ask you a quick question, because one of our listeners wrote in on our show page, what about those who grow up truly bilingual, really bilingual, that they really can slip in and out of each language perfectly? Do they have a dual set of ways that they perceive the world?
Well, it's an extremely good question, one that I had dozens of people asking me. And the honest answer is that we don't know very much, because all this research is, as I said, really in its infancy, and we are barely managing to understand, if you want, the simple cases. The truly bilingual people are obviously a much more complicated case. I think very little research has been done on it. Some research was done on bilinguals with respect to gender. This is another example, something that we mentioned before, but where languages that have gender systems, in which inanimate objects are treated as male or female languages, again, most languages of Europe, French, German, Italian, Russian, and so on. And it seems that the associations that are imposed in this way, or the grammatical habits of talking about whatever apples and tables as he or she, create associations in speakers' minds and really cause the speakers to think of or associate female or male characteristics with objects.
You mentioned the word bridge in your article, that the word bridge in German is feminine, if I'm getting it right, and in Spanish it's masculine. Does it really play out that the bridges are designed more feminine in one culture and more masculine in another?
Well, I raise that as a possibility of something that will need to be checked. I don't know of anyone who's actually looked at it seriously. But I had a very interesting email from a curator in a museum who was suggesting or asking whether one could try to look at look at it from the history of art point of view and see whether one can trace any such features in the design of things like furniture or other artistic objects from different cultures. But I think it's quite likely that it would have an effect, but this is as much as we can say now. But coming back to the bilingual question, I think there someone has tried to look at what happens in with people who grow up in two languages which both have gender systems but where the genders clash quite often, like German or German and French. I think the results were quite confusing. I think it is a fascinating question, but I think we should give it a few more years to get more, perhaps less confusing answers about it.
You mentioned that there's a big project underway to preserve endangered languages. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, this is really a race against time that linguists in the last, more and more in the last few years have been engaged in. There are currently estimated to be about 6,000 languages in the world. And again, this is a very rough estimation, but people say that probably about half of them will have gone by the end of this century. And those, the languages that are dying, are invariable, or almost all of them are those of small, simple pre-industrial societies. And these are exactly the languages that do things extremely differently from what we think of as natural. Just as an example, the Guguimisi, the language I was speaking about before, which inspired the whole research on the language of space because it speaks about space in such an odd way, is essentially almost dead now. The older generation of people who the research with them started in the 70s and 80s. They're all dead, and the older generation now, although they still speak the language, speak some sort of combination of Guguimisi and English.
We did a story here on this show about Globish and the growth of English around the world. You say all these languages are dying off. Is it being replaced by English only, or are there other languages as well?
No, it's not just English. I mean, English is probably the major killer language, if you want, but in South America it would be Spanish, where the indigenous languages are giving way to. The point is that we quite often hear about, in sort of many sentimental stories, about why it's so important to preserve these languages. But I think that beyond or above all these sentimental reasons, there's there are really cool scientific reasons why it's so important, at least to document as much as we can before it all disappears. And that is exactly that the languages that are dying are the ones that are really different. And if, for example, if researchers hadn't cottoned on to this incredible oddity in Guguimisi before the sort of older speakers died, then we would never have known that something like this is possible in a human language. We would have happily continued to say that all languages behave essentially like English in having relying primarily on these egocentric coordinates. And we would have said that forever happily and we would have had a completely misguided understanding of what really is natural for the human brain and what is just happens to be a convention that we are used to.
Thank you. Guy, we're going to have to leave it there. His Guy Deutscher's new book is Through the Language Glass, Why the World Looks Different Through Other Languages. It's out this month from Metropolitan Books. Guy, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.